Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning there, Marky.
Hey, Francis. How are you today?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
I was walking the streets the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And
you were?
Well.
Where exactly were you, Francis?
Let's just say I was strolling the streets the other day.
And you probably didn't make very much money.
And I came by. I'm ignoring that. I came by a menu. And one of the issues that we face is we often go out. We have a lot of friends who are restaurant reviewers, thank heaven, because when you go out with them, you don't have to pay for dinner. But then we always buy wine that would have cost more. We're like, we'll get the wine and you, but it's nice. So one of the things that is a pet peeve of many reviewers is when restaurants put things in French
mm-hmm.
or in Italian, you've got to get it right.
Right.
If you don't speak Italian and no one on your staff speaks Italian, or you can't hire someone to speak Italian to review the Italian portion of your menu, don't put Italian on there. You know.
Or even if you speak Italian but can't spell it.
Right.
Okay,
right. So you know, and I love that, you know, sometimes when menus sort of mix it up because they're like mm-hmm. primi piatti. Main courses. Primi piatti, secondi, you know what I mean? So
shrimp
it's,
with asparagi.
I think that when a restaurant, first of all, I think the old school where you'd go into an Italian restaurant that was just Italian, have to have a waiter translate for you from 30 years ago.
Hated it.
You're in America, translate the menu. Okay, fine. But if you're going to use a different language, it's really pretentious. It's stupid if you get it wrong. You know, I mean, most
yes.
people aren't going to know, but it's still stupid.
I think it's pretentious if you only put the Italian, if you're in, you know, Arkansas and you put only Italian on your menu.
Well, even if you're in New York, only Italian. We speak English here.
Right.
Translate the menu if you want. If you want your Italian, only Italian people to come, that's fine. But you got to get it right. So, like on our menu at Catherine Lombardi, which is, it's an Italian-American restaurant. We mm-hmm. used Italian words for the Italian words that Mark's grandmother would call things,
mm-hmm.
would use them. And we have friends of ours who speak Italian and write Italian proofread our menus to make sure that we're getting it right. And so I'm, you know,
right, because I'm phonetically sounding out all these things going, that's not right.
Right. And I'm Irish boy. What do I know about Italian except for, you know, it doesn't look like the menus I've seen in Italy. So I saw a menu that was particularly awful that I just wanted to wanted to mention. So as always with the restaurants that are ridiculous, we don't mention the names of the restaurants. But what this restaurant had was they had a very unique thing.
Very unique.
Right. I'm sorry. It can't be very unique. It's the same thing. They had a dish called pappardello ai tartufo. Okay. Here's the problem with that. Pappardelli is a long, flat pasta. It's like
half the width of lasagna, let's say.
Right. And long, flat. It's probably my favorite pasta. My favorite pasta. Now, pappardelli is the plural of pappardello. That's why ravioli means mm-hmm. many of them. Raviolo, you would just get just one.
One big raviolo.
So this is pappardello ai tartufo, and ai is plural. So pappardello would be basically like one very long piece of pasta, you know, like a snake in a basket. You know, imagine what it would be to cook that thing, all right? So that's ridiculous, number one. You got to get your
Yeah, the
spelling.
Magician's rope of pasta is not really what we're looking for.
That would be a very expensive dish. They could actually pull it off, you know what I mean? So it's pappardelle ai tartufo, and truffles are out of season, so I don't know where they're getting the truffles. But and the wine match is white Zinfandel.
And you thought,
that's not right.
What are you thinking?
Now, look, I know I sound like pretentious Francis guy here, but here's the deal.
Well, usually.
I am a little, but here's the deal with White Zinfandel. White Zinfandel as a beverage, like a Coke, mm-hmm. is fine. It's a simple wine. It's a byproduct. When you make good red Zinfandel, you throw off a little White Zinfandel. It's usually artificial. It's usually sweetened.
But you know what? When I go to a restaurant, mm-hmm. and forget that it's sweetened, forget all the rest of the stuff. When I go to the restaurant, what I want is someone who knows more about that dish and that wine than I do
right.
to put those things together and make something magical happen. When I go to a restaurant, that's what I want.
Nothing magical is happening with the White Zinfandel.
And the truffles.
Unless they make it disappear.
So let me see if I can put this in perspective for you. Okay, White Zinfandel, one of the most inexpensive wines in the market.
And one of the worst to match with food. I mean, just doesn't go
and
with
And the
food.
Worst to match with food. With truffles, which cost anywhere, depending on the year, $1,000 to $3,000 a pound. What are you thinking?
Well, I have to say, though, their tartufo, which means truffles, the whole menu is $100. So unless you get like a microscopic.
Maybe they meant to say tarfudi.
Well, no, they can use. You mean tartufo?
No, tarfudi.
Oh, tarfudi.
The ice cream.
Right. Well, I think that when you go out and you want to do a wine pairing menu, if you're a restaurateur, listen, there's nothing wrong with not having a tasting menu with wines. But don't fudge it, man.
Right.
You know what I mean? And honestly, that matchup is so bad that even if you don't know anything.
It is. And again, I don't expect all our listeners to be wine food connoisseurs. But I do expect the people putting the menus together to have some semblance. That is just one of the worst combinations on the planet.
But what I'm saying is, if you just try it. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody just sat down and ate it, they'd go, oh, my God, you can't do that. You know? And you know what is happening more and more in restaurants in America is we're being more professional. And there's a lot of information out there. There's the internet out there. There are restaurant consultants out there. Mm-hmm. Actually, you could hire us. We're restaurant consultants.
Oh, stop it.
That was a shameless plug. But people look to restaurateurs now and chefs now. Now that we have a little more respect in society, to learn something, and why where you betray people's trust is they go to this nice and expensive restaurant and they say, you know, the pappardello a tartufo, we had the pappardello, and if you say that to a friend or if you say that to someone who speaks Italian, you sound ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
And look, as far as the customers are concerned. We don't need to ask our customers to know anything when they walk in the door.
Mm-hmm.
But if our customers trust us, we need our customers to know that, especially on the high end, the restaurants are not telling you things that are wrong. And I think that's super important.
One of the things that's a pet peeve for Francis and me, and you should know, obviously this comes out, we hate pretenders.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can't stand somebody who's pretending to know a lot. Now, does that mean we hate, you know, lower-end restaurants?
Great restaurants?
Absolutely not. Francis and I have been to Rutz Hut Hot Dog Place many times together because they're the best hot dogs in the best hot dogs
in
the world.
And if you order two fried hot dogs with a skin rips and an orange soda, they scream into the microphone, two rippers and a howdy.
And a Frenchy grave.
It is
a French fry with brown gravy on it.
But that's
not what this is about. This is about when you go to a high-end restaurant and you order something, you want it to be great and you want it to be right.
Our guest when we have coming up later is the author of a new book on piracy. Bruce Necht will be joining the Restaurant Guys, so stay tuned. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey, 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, with Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Bruce Necht. Bruce Necht is a prize-winning writer for the Wall Street Journal. He's also written a book called The Proving Ground. His work has appeared in Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times Magazine, Condé Nast Traveler. He's an avid sailor. Last year, he raced across the Atlantic Ocean on a yacht that broke the 100-year-old transatlantic record. And his new book is a thriller called Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Your book is pretty amazing. Is it now? If people are wondering out in the audience why we have Bruce on the restaurant show, this is about pirate fishing. And is your book more a thriller or more an environmental tale?
Well, it's interesting. It's kind of both. It opens up as a sort of a high seas adventure story, and it is. It's a story of a chase that went 4,000 miles around Antarctica, literally halfway around Antarctica, through an obstacle course of icebergs and packed ice and through hurricane-force winds. And so it certainly is an adventure story, but then it has this other part, which is the part that is more related to the kinds of things you talk about more typically.
And this lasted for weeks.
It lasted for 3 weeks, 4,000 miles. I actually came close to calling it in the book the longest chase in maritime history, but I was just afraid that somebody, you know, reading the book or listening to a show like yours would call in and say, you know what, the British Navy chased some, you know, vessel for 4,500 miles.
Right, or we learn all of a sudden.
1753. So I kind of held back from saying that.
Yeah, we learn all of a sudden that someone was chasing Magellan all that time, and that
exactly,
was the motivation.
Exactly.
Hey, can I read a little from your book, because I think the wonderful thing about it is it's a thriller. It's a high seas thriller.
Sure. I hope you picked a good part.
Well, we'll see, and I'm going to skip around a little bit. But just to go out there and listen, you got to pick up this book, and you can find it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. But the Southern Supporter was the name of the book that was closed. That was that
the ship
that was doing the chase. Southern Supporter was in silent mode as it closed in on its target. The external lights were off. The portholes had been blackened, and no one touched the radio. The radar was activated only twice an hour, each time for less than a minute, to check for icebergs. One day earlier, a sensor on an Australian patrol boat had picked up the outbound radar emissions from three nearby vessels. All of them appeared to be just west of Heard Island, an uninhabited scrap of land halfway between South Africa and Australia, 900 miles north of Antarctica. It was the dead of winter, and the island, virtually barren and almost completely covered by glaciers, was buffeted by air so cold that the windborne salt water had formed horizontal icicles against the rails of the ship. "I don't want to have an intercept before dawn," Duffy told Andrew Coddington, Southern Supporter's captain. "For now, I'd like to head slowly towards them, 6 knots or less. If they happen to see us, they'll assume we're pirates, too." Nautical confrontations were nothing new to Duffy. He'd conducted forced boardings of more than 100 ships during a distinguished naval career, after which he joined customs to help create a marine patrol unit. Duffy didn't really look like the kind of person to be battling modern-day pirates. At 42, after many years at sea, his face was surprisingly unlined. He looked more like an overgrown Boy Scout. After the three ships were detected, Duffy and Coddington spent the entire night on the Southern Supporter's Bridge, where the illuminated instrument panels and tensor lights produced a high-tech orange glow. If it weren't for the heaving motion, the compartment, which stretched from one side of the ship to the other, would have looked like the control room of a power plant. That's pretty good prose, man.
Well, thank you.
is your mission, what brought you to write this book, which is obviously, I mean, you could have put any topic and sort of not had it be so germane to reality. What brought you to this topic?
Well, the truth is it wasn't my idea. You mentioned a previous book that I wrote, The Proving Ground. That was about the Sydney to Hobart race, the race that in 1998, the yachting race that led boats sinking and several people died. That book was a big bestseller in Australia, and the Australian publisher of the book told me about this chase about 3 years ago. And he told me that the boat that was being chased was filled with what you Americans call Chilean sea bass. And he told me that this chase had been front page news in Australia for 3 weeks. And that grabbed my attention, because the idea that something that was such big news in Australia, something that was all about a fish that we Americans are the main consumers of, how that could be such big news there and caused really not even a ripple here. It didn't even make the newspapers here. And that sort of disconnect, you know, people talk about the world becoming a smaller place, but this was clearly a global disconnect. And in that, you know, I began to sort of see that there was a book that would include the adventure story of this incredible chase, but it would also tell the story of how this fish, that nobody really knows where it came from, nobody really knew, you know, how it became so incredibly popular in our country. I wanted to sort of have this parallel story of basically the fish, how it came to America.
Why do you think there was such a disconnect between the two continents?
Well, in part just because of geography. I don't think, you know, if people listening today, if we were to conduct an instant poll, where does Chilean sea bass come from? I think they'd probably say it comes from Chile. I think if we said, is it a bass? They would say, no, it's probably sophisticated food people on the air. So some people would say, oh, no, you know what? I heard it's not a bass. Well, that's true. I didn't know that. It's not a bass.
Hey, you know what?
And then if you asked, is it caught illegally or legally, they'd probably be surprised to learn that almost all of it's caught illegally.
And that's a pretty good point, which we're going to deal with after this break in just a moment. Our guest is Bruce Neck. His thriller is called Hooked, Pirates Poaching and the Perfect Fish. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Bruce Neck. His book, which is amazing, and you can find out about how to get it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, is Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish.
Bruce, I think you need to explain to our listeners how a fish could possibly be illegal. How does a fish become illegal?
Well, it's not the fish that's illegal. It's the fishermen who are behaving illegally or legally, depending on whether they have a permit. It would be no different from you or I going to, you know, Lake Apacon or something. And you know, if we needed a permit to fish there, we could either go and get the permit or we could say, you know what, let's not bother. If we didn't bother, we would be breaking the law. Mm-hmm. But we're not talking about catching one fish. You know, in Hooked, I write about this vessel. The vessel being chased is the Viarsa. The Viarsa fished with 15,000 baited hooks at a time, which stretched for, you know, 12 miles, and they could catch 10, 20, 30 tons of fish in a single day. So, you know, there's illegal fishing, and then there's big-time illegal fishing, and that's what I'm talking about in Hooked.
You've said before the break that almost all of the Chilean sea bass, which is Patagonian toothfish, in the United States, being brought into the United States, is probably illegal. Can you tell us, is that really true?
Well, you know, maybe I went too far if I said almost all of it. I believe it's the majority. But, you know, the truth is nobody really knows because the illegal stuff, of course, the people importing that, you know, they don't say we're importing illegal Chilean sea bass. In fact, they don't say we're importing, you know, sea bass or Chilean sea bass at all. They'll import it. There's lots of ways you can do it. They can get phony documentation that says it was caught legally, or they can put it. The fish is all frozen. That's probably something else you're.
That's
realize.
The point I was just about to bring out is that it is. I have never seen fresh Patagonian toothfish.
Well, you might have actually. I mean, it used to be there was a supply when they were still catching it in off the coast of Chile. There were flights making it to, you know, big cities on the West Coast and the East Coast that were fresh. But since the pirates have, the industrial fishing that's been done by the pirates has really just ravaged those fisheries off Chile.
Bruce, we need to take a short break for the news, but when we come back, we're going to be talking more about modern-day piracy with Bruce Neck, author of Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is Bruce Necht. He is the prize-winning writer for the Wall Street Journal. He also works for has written in the Atlantic Monthly, New York Times Magazine. His first book that we read was The Proving Ground, and his current book is Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. Now, Bruce, you call the illegal fishing of Chilean sea bass, and if you've missed the first half of the show, we find that most of the Chilean sea bass that comes into the country is fished illegally. You call it piracy. I think of piracy as, well, aside from the Peter Pan connotations, I think of it as, you know, stealing a ship. Why do you call illegal fishing piracy?
They were a major ship that's operating illegally in international waters and waters that belong to another country. It's, you know, the definition of piracy includes lots of things, and certainly including what these folks were doing, which is basically stealing, 300 tons of fish that belong to Australia.
They're stealing a natural resource that belongs to another country.
In enormous quantities, and you know, in some sense, they're stealing it from you know, the world, in mm-hmm. the sense that they're taking it. You know, this kind of fishing is really strip mining. You know, when you they work sometimes with four or five vessels at the same time, and if you have four or five vessels that are each catching 20 to 30 tons of fish every day, you know, it doesn't take very long before they're gone.
You know,
but they're infinite. I mean, there's an infinite amount of fish in the world, isn't there?
You
we can just
like
fish
a,
and fish.
You sound like a fisherman.
Yeah.
You know, that has been, you know, I think in the old days, fishermen really believed that. I think everybody probably believed that, you know, but the evidence is, you know, to the contrary. I mean, if you look at any of the species we like to eat, you know, their populations for the most part are less than 10% today of what they were 50 years ago.
All the big fish, everybody, every study I've read is that all the large predator fish in the world, their stocks are now 10% of what they were.
Or less. I mean, cod is less than 5%.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The reason why we don't know that is because that's one of those things we hear and we don't necessarily believe it. I didn't really believe it until I learned more about it before I started working on the book. And I think part of the reason for that is when you go to a fish market or a supermarket, there's a lot of fish there.
Mm-hmm.
Take a look and you know, see if you can ask the guy behind the counter where they come from. And where they come from is mostly faraway places. You know, we've gone from being a country we consumers consume fish that came from relatively nearby bodies of water to, you know, become a nation where we have things like tilapia, you know, that comes from Southeast Asia. You know, the shrimp come from, you know, Thailand. You know, tuna come from the South Pacific. You know, it's, if you really look carefully, go, you know, fish by fish,
mm-hmm.
it's a whole different collection of fish than our grandparents or parents were eating.
Because they're gone,
right.
The ones that our grandparents
were
eating.
But the other thing
they're gone or they're in such small quantities, you know, the fishermen call it, you know, commercially extinct, which mm-hmm. is to say there's just so few there that it's not worth trying anymore.
The other thing I want to tell people to do is when you go to the store, take a look. Because wild caught is so in vogue right now, look around at the number of fish that actually read wild caught in as you go through the counter or your fishmonger or wherever, and what you'll see is maybe at this time of year we'll get a little bit of wild caught salmon in that case, but almost everything else will be farm raised.
And by the way, they every time they do a study on these wild caught fish that are sold in the supermarkets, they found that most of them are fraudulently labeled. Most of mm-hmm. them are farm raised fish.
Well, yeah.
That are labeled wild caught.
But even wild caught, you know, let's think about what that really means. You know, I think people, when they see the label, for the most part, you know, they're imagining, you know, a guy or a couple guys on mm-hmm. a fishing boat, you know. They're not imagining a factory ship, you know, near Antarctica, where they're reeling them in, you know, by the tens of tons, and they call it a factory, but what they actually do is, you know, cut the heads off of the fish, the tails with a bandsaw, and rip the guts out and freeze them, and then bring them, you know, to some dock in some place like Mauritius and put them in containers, and then weeks, maybe months, maybe more than a year later, you're finding it in the store. Now, that's not the scenario I think most people think of when they see a label that says wild line caught.
Right, of course.
Now, a few years back, it was around 02, 03, Francis and I signed a pledge that we would no longer sell Chilean sea bass.
It was a national movement of over 1,000 chefs now that's it's called
Take a Pass on Chilean Sea Bass. Now, has that had an effect on what's going on as far as the consumption of Chilean sea bass?
Well, first of all, I might as well give you a little bit of a pat on the back for people who don't know about this campaign. this was not just a petition that, chefs signed. This was a pledge that said, we're not going to serve the fish anymore. And I don't know about you, but
right.
a lot of the people who signed this pledge were serving the fish in very large quantities. In
sure.
many cases, it was the best-selling, you know, fish on the menu.
It was the number one selling fish on our menu.
Right. So it was a, you know, unlike signing a petition, which we do all the time, this had, you know, economic consequences.
Sure. We took a bit of a hit. But we found other stuff because we're smart and we're
right.
good restaurateurs.
So 1,000 chefs signed it. Again, this will sound like a pat on the back. It tended to be, you know, the better regarded chefs, the better known chefs. There's a lot more chefs than 1,000 out there, as you well know.
Yeah.
And the chefs that didn't sign the pledge include the people who serve it in much higher quantities than, you know, than you ever did,
mm-hmm.
which is to say hotels, caterers. You know, if you, one of the reasons, the subtitle of the book is, Pirates Poaching and the Perfect Fish. The reason for the perfect fish part is this is a fish, you can give it any spice, you can cook it any way you like it, and if you want to cook it in large quantities, let's say you have 100 people coming for a wedding,
it holds.
Could cook it in the afternoon and you could reheat it. Just before you
and almost no other fish does.
It's very hard to ruin.
And that's a fish that, I mean, you know better than me. Fish doesn't have that kind of resilience.
Right.
It's very unusual.
Retains a lot of moisture, which is the issue.
I want to say something here. Part of the move behind the Take a Pass on Chilean Sea Bass campaign was to target high profile chefs. And one of the reasons that we got involved and so many of our friends like Rick Moonen got involved from RMC mm-hmm. Food in Las Vegas now, but he was in New York at the time.
Rick Moonen is, by the way, 2 chapters in the book.
Yeah, I know. He's also a friend of ours. Grills a mean steak, by the way, for a seafood guy. A little barbecue in my backyard once. But the reason that people like him are important, he does sell a lot of fish in Las Vegas at RMC Food, but the reason that the high-profile chefs and good restaurateurs got involved was to get the word out, was to help get the word out to you. And when people ask, you in the listening audience, when people ask in our restaurants, well, do you have Chilean sea bass? We say no, and we explain why. Now, listen, everybody. 90% of the world's big fish have been decimated, not over the last 200 years, over the last 50 years, okay? So let's do some math here. I'm not being an alarmist. If we've decimated 90% in the last 50 years and we keep doing what we're doing, what happens in the next 20 years? And that's, I mean, if you look at, let's look at a specific example of the Chilean sea bass. A fleet of pirate fishing vessels decimated South Africa's toothfish population in 2 years. It's now extinct off of South Africa. And so
took almost 100 years to do that to the cod.
Right. And when they're extinct, these populations don't necessarily rebound. You think, okay, well, as long as we have 2 fish left, they can rebuild the population. That's not how ecology works. And so we're asking you, and Bruce, I think, will join us in asking you to take a pass on Chilean sea bass. And when you're in a restaurant and you see Chilean sea bass on the menu, just in a friendly way say, you know, it would be better if you didn't have this on the menu. Do you know that it's going extinct? What do you think, Bruce?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, we're sounding like environmentalists when we talk like this, but I sort of reject that, and some people who have been interviewing me have been saying, you know, well, you sound like a real environmentalist, and I always kind of react negatively to that because, I think what I'm being is a realist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have to take a quick break. We'll come back in just a moment. Our guest is Bruce Necht. His amazing thriller is called Hooked, Pirates Poaching and the Perfect Fish. You'll find out about it on our website back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And I mean, one of my favorite books that I've read in a while is Hooked, Pirates Poaching in the Perfect Fish by Bruce Necht. Bruce is on this line with us today. And I want everybody to know that this is a high seas chase. The book is about an Australian customs vessel. Is it a naval vessel or a customs vessel?
It's a customs vessel. You know, it would have been, they don't have a Coast Guard in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
The Coast Guard is actually sort of part of the service that provides that same service is part of their customs service.
Mm-hmm. And I want to tell people, because we do talk a lot on this show about Chilean sea bass, Patagonian toothfish, and being extinct, and people who write letters and books about how we can change that. This book is, while that's the point it addresses, is more of a thriller than that. It's a different kind of book.
And so this Australian vessel chases, in the longest sea chase in recent memory, chases this pirate fishing vessel and eventually catches up to it and has a forced boarding. Talk to us about how that all went down and the thriller aspect of the book.
Well, the first thing that happened when the Australian government vessel spotted the ship, they spotted them by electronics. And, you know, the bad guys, the pirates, they are sophisticated, too. They're watching with their radar. And as soon as they saw this vessel coming after them, they assumed they were, you know, government boats. So they ran. They ran directly south, which is to say towards Antarctica.
Towards the icebergs.
Towards the icebergs and into a huge storm, you know, 40-foot waves in the first afternoon of the chase. A couple days later, when they're actually, you know, at the ice, the pirate basically turned right and sort of, you know, started playing cat and mouse in the ice. And that went on for, you know, the 4,000 miles. Now, ultimately, as you say, they've gone all the way around, and they're in the deep South Atlantic, and the good guys are joined by a South African ship and a British ship, and there is a forced boarding. But the difficulty is when you're looking for evidence of illegal fishing that's going to stand up in court, it's very hard to find, because evidence means, you know, photographs of somebody actual fishing or recapturing fishing gear in the water where they were fishing and somehow being able to connect that fishing gear to the fishing vessel. Very tough to do when mm-hmm. they're looking out for you and they run before you even have visual contact.
So how was this prosecuted? The trial, and then the book moves from the high seas to a courtroom drama. Talk to us about the trial and how things went down in trying to prosecute these guys once they were caught on the high seas.
Well, it became a huge case, and it turned on what evidence there was and you know, alternate scenarios. I tell you, the best part about the case for me was the fishing master. You know, this boat was owned by a Spanish company, Spanish individual, really, and the fishing master was the guy on board who was in charge. You know, he's a guy that the ship filled up with 300 tons of fish. That's worth $3.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
He gets 5% of that. Well, one of the first days of the trial, I'm walking through Perth, west coast of Australia, down a street filled with, you know, restaurants and bars. And I look in the window of this attractive-looking bar, and I see Antonio Perez having a beer, you know, a couple hours after the trial.
Yeah.
Now, I knew he wasn't in jail, but I was still a little bit surprised, you know.
For those who haven't read the book, Antonio Perez is one of the villains in the book.
He's one of the villains, but, you know, I didn't, you know, I was with a little bit of a dilemma at that point. You know, mm-hmm. so we went in to talk to him. I was a bit intimidated, to tell
mm-hmm.
you the truth.
Right.
But then I realized, well, I'm a journalist. I got to go talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be incredibly valuable because he knew who I was. I was the only American journalist in the courtroom. And we sat down, we had a beer, and it became apparent to me he didn't think of himself as being a bad guy at all. He thinks these laws that countries like Australia that have, where they claim we do the same thing, you know, 200 miles around every speck of land we have, and we say that we can only fish, you know, exclusively within those 200 miles. He thinks laws that like that are really not designed to protect fish.
Does he think?
He thinks they're designed to, you know, protect domestic fishermen who are not as good as he is.
Mm-hmm. But one of the things that we need to realize here is most countries don't put those kinds of quotas in. until a lot of that damage is already done. So when we're talking about some of the quotas that are, that there are for Patagonian toothfish, or also known as Chilean sea bass, you're talking about things that, that came in kind of late in the game already. So for people to be fishing on top of that, it is really dangerous.
How did he react when to how does he respond to the idea that, well, you know, Patagonian toothfish might be fished off the planet? How does a person
Says several things about that, ranging from the, you know, from the ridiculous to the possibly believable. For instance, he told me that he only catches male fish. You know, well, you know, that's just absurd.
How does he do that?
And he says, well, when we do catch the female fish, we, you know, put the eggs back in the ocean. Well, that is technically true, because when you take the guts out of the fish, they do toss it back in the ocean. But it's also absurd, because those eggs tossed back in the ocean with the rest of the fish guts are not going to turn into
baby
fish.
They're not viable.
Right. And then he said something, and he may really...
But hold on a second. If he's tossing the eggs back in the ocean... Then, and he only catches male fish.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Something doesn't add up here.
Right. Yeah, well, the whole thing doesn't add up.
Right.
And what he finally says is, you know, when I kept pushing sort of at this the best I could, you know, with a little bit of a language barrier, so I couldn't really tell whether he believed either of those, you know, assertions or whether he was sort of, you know, doing it for a laugh, or maybe he thought I was, you know, dumb enough that I would, you know, just fall for it. The other thing he said was that if this fish... If we run out of this fish, and he knows we're running out of it, because he was one of the people who was fishing for it off Argentina and, you know, in South Africa.
And had to
until
move.
It was gone. He had to move on, you know, like a bunch of wolves. He and all the other, you know, fleets of pirates moved to the next spot.
Hold on a second. This is about to be a good point. We're going to have to take a quick break for a commercial. We'll come back in just a moment. Our guest again is Bruce Necht. His book is Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. You can find out about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, back at the restaurant, guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest is Bruce Necht. His book is Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. And you were just about to tell us, after this long sea chase, after the fishing master of this illegal fishing boat is brought to trial, you find him after the trial, and you're sitting in a bar, and you're talking with him. And you're about to tell us how he responds to the, okay, Chilean sea bass, if we keep fishing it like this, we're going to fish it out of existence. And his response to that is?
There'll be another fish. There always has been. You know, his family had been in the, that's his view anyway. His family is from Galicia, northwest part of Spain, where that's fishing has been pretty much all they do in that part of Spain for centuries, literally. And that's true of his family for as many generations as they can remember. These are the people who were fishing for cod off Newfoundland in the 1400s, you know, mm-hmm. the mid-1400s. You know, this myth about Columbus discovering America, that, you know, the Spanish were catching cod there for long before Columbus arrived. Now, so, you know, when they ran out of cod, and Antonio was fishing for cod too, he discovered this next fish, toothfish. But one of the points I make in the book is this is probably the end of the line. There are not other big fish out there, other fish that we're going to find attractive from a consumption point of view that have yet to be discovered. This is literally the bottom of the planet, you know, and there are other fish that live in even deeper water. I mean, we haven't mentioned this, but this fish we call Chilean sea bass lives in water up to a mile deep. You know, it wasn't until we had technology that fished that deep that we even began to catch fish like this. Now, there are fish that live in even deeper water, 3-4 miles deep, and you've probably seen pictures of them. They have these enormous eyeballs. They're, you know, they're pretty gruesome-looking fish. But I've never heard anybody who's suggesting that those are fish that we're going to find attractive
you know,
to eat or economically viable to actually harvest.
Yeah, most of the fish.
This is it. You know, that's what makes, you know, that's why, you know, in Hooked, I kind of, it was another good thing about this particular fish, because it kind of allowed me to make this point. There is no more, you know, there isn't the next fish.
People think that the oceans are vast and huge and cover 71% of the earth or 79% of the earth. But the reality is most of the fish are within 200 miles of land.
And the big fish are gone. Hey, Bruce, we got to run. News is coming up. Thank you for being on our show.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
It was a lot of fun. That's Bruce Necht. His book is Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. You can go to our website and find out more about it. You should pick it up. It's a great thriller, and it's also got a great and very important, very salient message. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.